This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Enrique's Journey, written by Sonia Nazario, performed by Catherine Byers.
Prologue. It is Friday morning, 8 a.m. I hear a key turn in the front door lock of my Los Angeles home. Maria del Carmen Ferris, who cleans my house every other week, opens the door. She walks into the kitchen. Carmen is petite, intelligent, and works at lightning speed. At this early hour, I am usually in a frenzy to get out the door and rush to my office. But on days when Carmen arrives, she and I shift gears. Carmen loiters in the kitchen, tidying things. I circle around her, picking up shoes, newspapers, socks, trying to give her a fighting chance at cleaning the floors. The ritual allows us to be in the same room and talk. On this morning in 1997, I lean on one side of the kitchen island. Carmen leans on the other side. There is a question, she says, that she has been itching to ask. Mrs. Sonia, are you ever going to have a baby? I'm not sure, I tell her. Carmen has a young son she sometimes brings to watch television while she works. Does she want more children, I ask. Carmen, always laughing and chatty, is suddenly silent. She stares awkwardly down at the kitchen counter. Then, quietly, she tells me about four other children I never knew existed. These children, two sons and two daughters, are far away, Carmen says, in Guatemala. She left them there when she ventured north as a single mother to work in the United States. She has been separated from them for 12 years. Her youngest daughter, Carmen says, was just a year old when she left. She has experienced her oldest boy, Minor, grow up by listening to the deepening timbre of his voice on the telephone. As Carmen unravels the story, she begins to sob. 12 years? I react with disbelief. How can a mother leave her children and travel more than 2,000 miles away, not knowing when or if she will ever see them again? What drove her to do this? Carmen dries her tears and explains. Her husband left her for another woman. She worked hard, but didn't earn enough to feed four children. They would ask me for food, and I didn't have it. Many nights, they went to bed without dinner. She lulled them to sleep with advice on how to quell their hunger pangs. Sleep face down so your stomach won't growl so much, Carmen said, gently coaxing them to turn over. She left for the United States out of love. She hoped she could provide her children an escape from their grinding poverty, a chance to attend school beyond the sixth grade. Carmen brags about the clothes, money, and photos she sends her children. She also acknowledges having made brutal trade-offs. She feels the distance, the lack of affection, when she talks with her children on the telephone. Day after day, as she misses milestones in their lives, her absence leaves deep wounds. When her oldest daughter has her first menstruation, she is frightened. She doesn't understand what is happening to her. Why, the girl asks Carmen, were you not here to explain? Carmen hasn't been able to save enough for a smuggler to bring them to the United States. Besides, she refuses to subject her children to the dangerous journey. During her own 1985 trek north, Carmen was robbed by her smuggler, who left her without food for 3 days. Her daughters, she fears, will get raped along the way. Carmen balks at bringing her children into her poor, drug- and crime-infested Los Angeles neighborhood. As she clicks the dishwasher on, Carmen, concerned that I might disapprove of her choice, tells me that many immigrant women in Los Angeles from Central America or Mexico are just like her. Single mothers who left children behind in their home countries. What's really incomprehensible, she adds, are middle-class or wealthy working mothers in the United States. These women, she says, could tighten their belts, stay at home, spend all their time with their children. Instead, they devote most of their waking hours and energy to careers, with little left for the children. Why, she asks, with disbelief on her face, would anyone do that? The following year, in 1998, unannounced, Carmen's son, Minor, sets off to find his mother. Carmen left him when he was 10 years old. He hitchhikes through Guatemala and Mexico. He begs for food along the way. He shows up on Carmen's doorstep. He has missed his mother intensely. He could not stand another Christmas or birthday apart. He was tired of what he saw as his mother's excuses for why they could not be together. He had to know. Did she leave Guatemala because she never truly loved him? How else could he explain why she left? Minor's friends in Guatemala envied the money and presents Carmen sent. "You have it all, good clothes, good tennis shoes," they said. Minor answered, "I'd trade it all for my mother. I never had someone to spoil me. To say, do this, don't do that. Have you eaten? You can never get the love of a mother from someone else." Minor tells me about his perilous hitchhiking journey. He was threatened and robbed. Still, he says, he was lucky. Each year, thousands of other children going to find their mothers in the United States travel in a much more dangerous way. The children make the journey on top of Mexico's freight trains. They call it El Tren de la Muerte, the train of death. A common choice. I was struck by the choice mothers face when they leave their children. How do they make such an impossible decision? Among Latinos, where family is all important, where for women motherhood is valued far above all else, why are droves of mothers leaving their children? What would I do if I were in their shoes? Would I come to the United States, where I could earn much more money and send cash back to my children? This would mean my sons and daughters could eat more than sugar water for dinner. They could study past the third grade, maybe even finish high school, go on to university classes. Or I could stay by my children's side, relegating another generation to the same misery and poverty I knew so well. I was also amazed by the dangerous journey these children make to try to be with their mothers. What kind of desperation, I wondered, pushes children as young as 7 years old to set out alone, through such a hostile landscape with nothing but their wits? The United States is experiencing the largest wave of immigration in its history, a level of newcomers that is once again transforming the country. Each year, an estimated 700,000 immigrants enter the United States illegally. Since 2000, nearly 1 million additional immigrants annually, on average, have arrived legally or become legal residents. This wave differs in one respect at least from the past. Before, when parents came to the United States and left children behind, it was typically the fathers, often Mexican guest workers called braceros, and they left their children with their mothers. In recent decades, the increase in divorce and family disintegration in Latin America has left many single mothers without the means to feed and raise their children. The growing ranks of single mothers paralleled a time when more and more American women began working outside the home. There is an insatiable need in the United States for cheap service and domestic workers. The single Latin American mothers began migrating in large numbers, leaving their children with grandparents, other relatives, or neighbors. The first wave was in the 1960s and 1970s. Single mothers from a smattering of Caribbean countries, the West Indies, Jamaica, the Dominican Republic, headed to New York City, New England, and Florida to work as nannies and in nursing homes. Later, Central American women flocked to places with the greatest demand, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., Houston, and Los Angeles, where the number of private domestic workers doubled in the 1980s. Carmen's experience is now common. In Los Angeles, a University of Southern California study showed 82% of live-in nannies and one in four house cleaners are mothers who still have at least one child in their home country. A Harvard University study showed that 85% of all immigrant children who eventually end up in the United States spent at least some time separated from a parent in the course of migrating to the United States. In much of the United States, legitimate concerns about immigration and anti-immigrant measures have had a corrosive side effect. Immigrants have been dehumanized and demonized. Their presence in the United States is deemed good or bad, depending on the perspective. Immigrants have been reduced to cost-benefit ratios. Perhaps by looking at one immigrant, his strengths, his courage, his flaws, his humanity might help illuminate what too often has been a black-and-white discussion. Perhaps, I start thinking, I could take readers on top of these trains and show them what this modern-day immigrant journey is like, especially for children. This, a Los Angeles woman who helps immigrants told me, is the adventure story of the 21st century. Fear and fleas. For a good while, I sat on the idea. As a journalist, I love to get inside the action, watch it unfold, take people inside worlds they might never otherwise see. I wanted to smell, taste, hear, and feel what this journey is like. In order to give a vivid, nuanced account, I knew I would have to travel with child migrants through Mexico on top of freight trains. I thought about starting in Central America and tagging along as one boy tries to reach his mother in the United States. Carmen's son, Minor, had already explained enough about the trip for me to grasp that this was just shy of nutty. He'd told me about the gangsters who rule the train tops, the bandits along the tracks, the Mexican police who patrol the train stations, and rape and rob, about the dangers of losing a leg getting onto and off of moving trains. In short, I was afraid. Then there was the issue of marital harmony. I'd just finished another project that involved hanging out in dark garages and shacks with speed, heroin, and crack addicts. My husband had spent months fretting about my safety. He'd had to ask politely that I strip in our garage each evening when I came home after hanging out in addicts' apartments. Apparently, I'd been bringing home a healthy population of fleas. Talk of strapping myself to the top of a train, I figured, was not likely to be received with open ears. A year later, I hoped the memory of fleas had faded. I decided to move forward. Cautiously. First, I learned everything I could about the journey. What's the exact route? The best and worst things that happen at each step of the way. The places where migrants encounter the greatest cruelty. And the greatest kindness. Critical turning points in the journey. What are the favorite areas along the tracks where the gangs rob? Where the bandits kill people? Where do Mexican immigration authorities stop the train? I talked with dozens of children held by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service in four jails and shelters in California and in Texas. Many had ridden the trains. So had students I had spoken with at a special Los Angeles high school for recent immigrants. At a detention center in Los Fresnos, Texas, a talk with 15-year-old twins, Jose Enrique and Jose Luis Oliva Rosa, forced me to shred my initial plan. I realized that my first choice, to follow one boy from the beginning of his journey in Central America to the end with his mother in the United States, wasn't doable. The twins had left Honduras to find their mother in Los Angeles. During the months they spent running for their lives in Mexico, they were separated from each other four times. Only sheer luck had allowed them to find each other. I can't run as fast as a 15-year-old. I also can't rely on that level of luck. I had to find a boy who had made it to northern Mexico and follow him to his mother in the United States. I would have to reconstruct the earlier part of his journey. Children at the Texas Center also brought home the dangers I would face making such a journey. At the Texas Center was Eber Ismael Sandoval Andino, 11, a petite boy with dark eyes and machete marks crisscrossing his legs. The marks were from working in the coffee farms of Honduras since he was 6 years old. On his train rides through Mexico, he told me he had witnessed 5 separate incidents where migrants had been mutilated by the train. He'd seen a man lose half a foot getting on the train. He'd seen 6 gangsters draw their knives and throw a girl off the train to her death. Once he'd fallen off the train and landed right next to the churning steel wheels. "I thought I was dead. I turned stone cold," he said. The director of the Texas Center told me I'd be an idiot to attempt this train journey, that I could get myself killed. "These kids," he said, motioning to the children around him, "don't really understand the dangers they will face. They go into it with their eyes closed. They don't know any better." I understood the exact risks. I would be doing it out of sheer stupidity. I am not a brave person. I grew up in part in Argentina during the genocidal Dirty War, when the military disappeared up to 30,000 people. Often I walked to school with a friend in case something should happen to one of us. My mother burned the family's books in a pile in the backyard to avoid trouble if the military ever came to search our Buenos Aires home. We kept the windows closed so neighbors could not hear any discussion that strayed from the mundane into anything vaguely political. Among the disappeared and murdered was a teenage friend, who we heard had been tortured, the bones in his face shattered. A relative was abducted by the military, tortured, and released many months later. I avoid danger if possible. If I need to do dangerous things to really understand something, I try to build in as many safety nets as possible. I redoubled my efforts to reduce my exposure while making the journey. I lay down one rule: no getting onto and off of moving trains, a rule I broke only once. A newspaper colleague plugged into the Mexican government helped me get a letter from the personal assistant to Mexico's president. The letter asked any Mexican authorities and police I encountered to cooperate with my reporting. The letter helped keep me out of jail 3 times. It also helped me convince an armed Mexican migrant rights group, Grupo Beta, to accompany me on the trains through the most dangerous leg of the journey, the Mexican state of Chiapas. At the time, the government's Grupo Beta agents, who are drawn from different police groups, carried shotguns and AK-47s. They had not patrolled the train tops for 14 months. Even with that firepower, they explained it was too dangerous. In 1999, their patrols had come under attack by gangsters 4 times. They agreed to make an exception. The letter helped me obtain permission to ride atop the trains of 4 companies that operate freight trains up the length of Mexico. That way the conductor would know when I was on board. I would tell them to be on the lookout for my signal. I'd wear a red rain jacket strapped around my waist and wave it if I was in dire danger. I tried to have a source in each region I'd be in, including his or her cell phone number, so I could call for help if I was in trouble. Finding Enrique. The average child the Border Patrol catches who comes alone over the U.S.-Mexico border is a 15-year-old boy. I wanted to find a boy who was coming for his mother and had traveled on the trains. In May 2000, I scoped out a dozen shelters and churches in Mexico along the 2,000-mile-long U.S. border that help migrants, including minors. I visited a few. I told each priest or shelter director what I was after. I called each place day after day to see if such a child had arrived. Soon, a nun at one of the churches in Nuevo Laredo, the Parroquia de San Jose, said she had a couple of teenagers who had come in for a free meal, a 17-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl. Both were headed north in search of their mothers. She put Enrique on the telephone. He was a little older than the INS average, but his story was typical, and just as harrowing as those I had heard from children in the INS jails. A few days later, I traveled to Nuevo Laredo and spent 2 weeks shadowing Enrique along the Rio Grande. I talked to other children but decided to stick with Enrique. In Nuevo Laredo, most of the children I spoke with, including Enrique, had been robbed of their mother's telephone numbers along the way. They hadn't thought to memorize the numbers. Unlike the others, Enrique recalled one telephone in Honduras he could call to try to get his mother's phone number in the United States. He still had a shot at continuing his journey and, perhaps, reaching his mother. From Enrique, I gleaned every possible detail about his life and trip north. I noted every place he had gone, every experience, every person he recalled who had helped or hindered him along the way. Then I began to retrace his steps, doing the journey exactly as he had done it a few weeks before. I wanted to see and experience things as he had, with the hope of describing them more fully. I began in Honduras, interviewing his family, seeing his haunts. I took buses through Central America, just as Enrique had done. In Mexico's southernmost state, Chiapas, I boarded a freight train. I took the same path along the rails, traveling up the length of Mexico on top of 7 freight trains. I got off where he did, in San Luis Potosí, then hitchhiked on an 18-wheeler from the same spot in the northern Mexican city of Matehuala, where Enrique had hitched a ride to the U.S. border. To follow Enrique's journey, I traversed 13 of Mexico's 31 states. I traveled more than 1,600 miles, half of that on top of trains. I found people who had helped Enrique and saw towns or crucial spots he had passed through or spent time in along the way. I showed people a photograph of Enrique to make sure we were talking about the same boy. I traveled on trains with other migrant children going to find their mothers, including a 12-year-old boy in search of his mother, who had left for San Diego when he was 1 year old. From Tegucigalpa through Mexico, I interviewed dozens of migrants and other experts, medical workers, priests, nuns, police officers. All this added to the journey and helped corroborate Enrique's story. I returned to Enrique 3 times to ask if he had seen or heard some of the many things I had witnessed during my journey. In all, I spent more than 6 months traveling in Honduras, Mexico, and the United States. In 2003, to conduct additional research, I retraced much of the journey again, beginning in Tegucigalpa. Following a dangerous path. For months, as I traveled in Enrique's footsteps, I lived with the near-constant danger of being beaten, robbed, or raped. Once, as I rode on top of a fuel car on a rainy night with lightning, a tree branch hit me squarely in the face. It sent me sprawling backward. I was able to grab a guardrail and keep from stumbling off the top of the train. On that same ride, I later learned a child had been plucked off the fuel tanker car behind mine by a branch. His train companions did not know if he was dead or alive. Even with the presence of the heavily armed Grupo Beta agents on trains as I rode through Chiapas, gangsters were robbing people at knife point at the end of our train. I constantly worried about gangsters on the trains. In Tierra Blanca, in the Mexican state of Veracruz, during a brief train stop, I feverishly tried to get the local police to find and arrest a notoriously vicious gangster named Blackie, after learning he was aboard the train I was about to reboard. Nearby, a train derailed right in front of mine. Train engineers have described incidents where migrants have been crushed as trains derail and cars tip over. At times, I came close to witnessing the worst the train had to offer. As I passed through the town of Encinar, Veracruz, I was riding between two hoppers with four other migrants. A teenage boy emerged from a railside food store to throw a roll of crackers to migrants on the train. A teenage migrant standing next to me was hungry. When the boy threw the roll toward the migrant beside me, it bounced off the train. As the migrant jumped off the hopper to run back for the crackers, he stumbled and fell backward. Both feet landed on the tracks. He had a split second to react. He yanked his feet back just before the wheels rolled over the track. Things weren't much safer by the side of the rails. I walked along the river that flows by the town of Ixtepec, Oaxaca. It seemed tranquil, a very safe public spot. Above me was the main bridge that crosses the river, busy with trains and pedestrians. The next day, I interviewed Karen, a 15-year-old girl who had been raped by two gangsters she had seen on the trains. Karen told me she had been raped right under the river's bridge. I had been alone one day before the rape at the very spot where Karen had been assaulted. In Chiapas, I hung out with Grupo Beta agents near the dangerous El Manguito immigration checkpoint. It is thick with bandits who target migrants. Suddenly, we were on a high-speed chase on a two-lane road, trying to reach three bandits in a red Jeep Cherokee who had robbed a group of migrants and driven off with one of them, a 22-year-old Honduran woman. I was in the bed of Grupo Beta's pickup. The pickup pulled up alongside the Cherokee, trying to force it to stop. A Grupo Beta agent stood in the pickup bed. He locked and loaded his shotgun and aimed at the bandit's vehicle. I was just feet from the Cherokee. I prayed that the bandits wouldn't open fire. Farther north, human rights activist Raimundo Ramos Vasquez gave me a tour of the most isolated spots along the Rio Grande, places where migrants cross. We stumbled across a migrant preparing to swim north. He explained that the last time he had been here, municipal police officers had arrived. They had cuffed his hands behind his back, he said, and put his face in the river, threatening to drown him if he didn't disclose where he had his money. As the migrant described the abuse, two police officers walked down the dirt path toward us. Their guns were drawn and cocked. When I returned to the United States, I had a recurring nightmare. Someone was racing after me on top of the freight trains, trying to rape me. It took months of therapy before I could sleep soundly again. Often in Mexico, I was tense. On the trains, I was filthy, unable to go to the bathroom for long stretches, excruciatingly hot or cold, pelted for hours by rain or hail. Although I often felt exhausted and miserable, I knew I was experiencing only an iota of what migrant children go through. At the end of a long train ride, I would pull out my credit card, go to a motel, shower, eat, and sleep. These children typically spend several months making their way north. During that time, in between train rides, they sleep in trees or by the tracks. They drink from puddles. They beg for food. The journey gave me a glimmer of how hard this is for them. Train top lessons. I thought I understood to a great extent the immigrant experience. My father, Mahafood, was born in Argentina after his Christian family fled religious persecution in Syria. My mother, Clara, born in Poland, emigrated to Argentina as a young child. Her family was fleeing poverty and the persecution of Jews. Many of her Polish relatives were gassed during World War II. My family emigrated to the United States in 1960. My father, a biochemistry professor working on genetic mapping, had greater resources and opportunities to conduct research here. He also wanted to leave behind a country controlled by the military, where academic expression was limited. I understood the desire for opportunity, for freedom. I also understood, due to the death of my father when I was a teenager, and the turbulent times my family experienced afterward, what it is like to struggle economically. Growing up as the child of Argentine immigrants in 1960s and 1970s Kansas, I have sometimes felt like an outsider. I know how difficult it is to straddle two countries, two worlds. On many levels, I relate to the experiences of immigrants and Latinos in this country. I have written about migrants on and off for two decades. Still, my parents arrived in the United States on a jet airplane, not on top of a freight train. My family was never separated during the process of immigrating to the United States. Until my journey with migrant children, I had no true understanding of what people are willing to do to get here. As I followed Enrique's footsteps, I learned the depths of desperation women face in countries such as Honduras. Most earn $40 to $120 a month working in a factory, cleaning houses, or providing child care. A hut with no bathroom or kitchen rents for nearly $30 a month. In rural areas of Honduras, some people live under a piece of tarp. They have no chairs or table and eat sitting on a dirt floor. Children go to school in threadbare uniforms, often unable to afford pencil or paper or buy a decent lunch. A Tegucigalpa elementary school principal told me that many of his students were so malnourished that they didn't have the stamina to stand up for long at school rallies or to sing the national anthem. Many Honduran mothers pull their children out of school when they are as young as 8. They have them watch younger siblings while they work or sell tortillas on a street corner. 7-year-olds sell bags of water on public buses or wait at taxi stands to make change for cab drivers. Some beg on Boulevard San Juan Pablo II. Domi Elizabeth Cortes, from Mexico City, described being despondent after her husband left her for another woman. The loss of his income meant she could feed her children only once a day. For weeks, she considered throwing herself and her 2 toddlers into a nearby sewage canal to drown together. Instead, she left her children with a brother and headed to Los Angeles. Day after day, mothers like Domi walk away from their children, some of them just a month old, and leave for the United States, not knowing if or when they will see them again. With each step north, I became awed by the gritty determination these children possess in their struggle to get here. They are willing to endure misery and dangers for months on end. They come armed with their faith, a resolve not to return to Central America defeated, and a deep desire to be at their mother's sides. One Honduran teenager I met in southern Mexico had been deported to Guatemala 27 times. He said he wouldn't give up until he reached his mother in the United States. I began to believe that no number of border guards will deter children like Enrique, who are willing to endure so much to reach the United States. It is a powerful stream, one that can only be addressed at its source. The migrants I spent time with also gave me an invaluable gift. They reminded me of the value of what I have. They taught me that people are willing to die in their quest to obtain it. The single mothers who are coming to this country, and the children who follow them, are changing the face of immigration to the United States. Each year, the number of women and children who immigrate to the United States grows. They become our neighbors, children in our schools, workers in our homes. As they become a greater part of the fabric of the United States, their troubles and triumphs will be a part of this country's future. For Americans overall, this book should shed some light on this part of our society. For Latina mothers coming to the United States, my hope is that they will understand the full consequences of leaving their children behind and make better informed decisions, for in the end, these separations almost always end badly. Every woman I interviewed in the United States who had left children behind had been sure the separation would be brief. Immigrants who come to the United States are by nature optimists. They have to be in order to leave everything they love and are familiar with for the unknown. The reality, however, is that it takes years and years until the children and mothers are together again, By the time that happens, if it happens, the children are usually very angry with their mothers. They feel abandoned. Their mothers are stunned by this judgment. They believe their children should show gratitude, not anger. After all, the mothers sacrificed being with their children, worked like dogs, all to help provide their children with a better life and future. Latina migrants ultimately pay a steep price for coming to the United States. They lose their children's love. Reunited, they end up in conflicted homes. Too often the boys seek out gangs to try to find the love they thought they would find with their mothers. Too often the girls get pregnant and form their own families. In many ways these separations are devastating Latino families. People are losing what they value most. Children who set out on this journey usually don't make it. They end up back in Central America, defeated. Enrique was determined to be with his mother again. Would he make it? 1. The boy left behind. The boy does not understand. His mother is not talking to him. She will not even look at him. Enrique has no hint of what she is going to do. Lourdes knows. She understands, as only a mother can, the terror she is about to inflict, the ache Enrique will feel, and finally the emptiness. What will become of him? Already he will not let anyone else feed or bathe him. He loves her deeply, as only a son can. With Lourdes, he is openly affectionate. Dame pico, mami. Give me a kiss, Mom, he pleads over and over, pursing his lips. With Lourdes, he is a chatterbox. Mira, mami. Look, Mom, he says softly, asking her questions about everything he sees. Without her, he is so shy, it is crushing. Slowly, she walks out onto the porch. Enrique clings to her pant leg. Beside her, he is tiny. Lourdes loves him so much she cannot bring herself to say a word. She cannot carry his picture. It would melt her resolve. She cannot hug him. He is 5 years old. They live on the outskirts of Tegucigalpa in Honduras. She can barely afford food for him and his sister Belki, who is 7. She's never been able to buy them a toy or a birthday cake. Lourdes, 24, scrubs other people's laundry in a muddy river. She goes door to door selling tortillas, used clothes, and plantains. She fills a wooden box with gum and crackers and cigarettes, and she finds a spot where she can squat on a dusty sidewalk next to the downtown Pizza Hut and sell the items to passers-by. The sidewalk is Enrique's playground. They have a bleak future. He and Belki are not likely to finish grade school. Lourdes cannot afford uniforms or pencils. Her husband is gone. A good job is out of the question. Lourdes knows of only one place that offers hope. As a 7-year-old child delivering tortillas her mother made to wealthy homes, she glimpsed this place on other people's television screens. The flickering images were a far cry from Lourdes's childhood home. A 2-room shack made of wooden slats, its flimsy tin roof weighted down with rocks, the only bathroom a clump of bushes outside. On television, she saw New York City's spectacular skyline, Las Vegas's shimmering lights, Disneyland's magic castle. Lourdes has decided she will leave. She will go to the United States and make money and send it home. She will be gone for 1 year, less with luck, or she will bring her children to be with her. It is for them she is leaving, she tells herself. But still, she feels guilty. She kneels and kisses Belki and hugs her tightly. Then she turns to her own sister. If she watches over Belki, she will get a set of gold fingernails from El Norte. But Lourdes cannot face Enrique. He will remember only one thing that she says to him. Don't forget to go to church this afternoon. It is January 29th, 1989. His mother steps off the porch. She walks away. ¿Dónde está mi mami? Enrique cries over and over. Where is my mom? His mother never returns, and that decides Enrique's fate. As a teenager, indeed still a child, he will set out for the United States on his own to search for her. Virtually unnoticed, he will become one of an estimated 48,000 children who enter the United States from Central America and Mexico each year, illegally, and without either of their parents. Roughly two-thirds of them will make it past the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. Many go north seeking work. Others flee abusive families. Most of the Central Americans go to reunite with a parent, say counselors at a detention center in Texas, where the INS houses the largest number of the unaccompanied children it catches. Of those, the counselors say, 75% are looking for their mothers. Some children say they need to find out whether their mothers still love them. A priest at a Texas shelter says they often bring pictures of themselves in their mother's arms. The journey is hard for the Mexicans, but harder still for Enrique and the others from Central America. They must make an illegal and dangerous trek up the length of Mexico. Counselors and immigration lawyers say only half of them get help from smugglers. The rest travel alone. They are cold, hungry, and helpless. They are hunted like animals by corrupt police, bandits, and gang members deported from the United States. A University of Houston study found that most are robbed, beaten, or raped, usually several times. Some are killed. They set out with little or no money. Thousands, shelter workers say, make their way through Mexico, clinging to the sides and tops of freight trains. Since the 1990s, Mexico and the United States have tried to thwart them. To evade Mexican police and immigration authorities, the children jump onto and off of the moving train cars. Sometimes they fall, and the wheels tear them apart. They navigate by word of mouth or by the arc of the sun. Often they don't know where or when they'll get their next meal. Some go days without eating. If a train stops even briefly, they crouch by the tracks, cup their hands, and steal sips of water from shiny puddles tainted with diesel fuel. At night, they huddle together on the train cars or next to the tracks. They sleep in trees, in tall grass, or in beds made of leaves. Some are very young. Mexican rail workers have encountered 7-year-olds on their way to find their mothers. A policeman discovered a 9-year-old boy near the downtown Los Angeles tracks. "I'm looking for my mother," he said. The youngster had left Puerto Cortes in Honduras 3 months before. He had been guided only by his cunning and the single thing he knew about her, where she lived. He had asked everyone, "How do I get to San Francisco?" Typically, the children are teenagers. Some were babies when their mothers left. They know them only by pictures sent home. Others, a bit older, struggle to hold on to memories. One has slept in her mother's bed. Another has smelled her perfume, put on her deodorant, her clothes. One is old enough to remember his mother's face. Another, her laugh, her favorite shade of lipstick, how her dress felt as she stood at the stove patting tortillas. Many, including Enrique, begin to idealize their mothers. They remember how their mothers fed and bathed them, how they walked them to kindergarten. In their absence, these mothers become larger than life. Although in the United States the women struggle to pay rent and eat, in the imaginations of their children back home, they become deliverance itself, the answer to every problem. Finding them becomes the quest for the Holy Grail. Confusion. Enrique is bewildered. Who will take care of him now that his mother is gone? Lourdes, unable to burden her family with both of her children, has split them up. Belki stayed with Lourdes's mother and sisters. For 2 years, Enrique is entrusted to his father, Luis, from whom his mother has been separated for 3 years. Enrique clings to his daddy, who dotes on him. A bricklayer, his father takes Enrique to work and lets him help mix mortar. They live with Enrique's grandmother. His father shares a bed with him and brings him apples and clothes. Every month, Enrique misses his mother less, but he does not forget her. "When is she coming for me?" he asks. Lourdes and her smuggler cross Mexico on buses. Each afternoon, she closes her eyes. She imagines herself home at dusk, playing with Enrique under a eucalyptus tree in her mother's front yard. Enrique straddles a broom, pretending it's a donkey, trotting around the muddy yard. Each afternoon she presses her eyes shut and tears fall. Each afternoon she reminds herself that if she is weak, if she does not keep moving forward, her children will pay. Lourdes crosses into the United States in one of the largest immigrant waves in the country's history. She enters at night through a rat-infested Tijuana sewage tunnel and makes her way to Los Angeles. There, in the downtown Greyhound bus terminal, the smuggler tells Lourdes to wait while he runs a quick errand. He'll be right back. The smuggler has been paid to take her all the way to Miami. 3 days pass. Lourdes musses her filthy hair, trying to blend in with the homeless and not get singled out by police. She prays to God to put someone before her to show her the way. Whom can she reach out to for help? Starved, she starts walking. East of downtown, Lourdes spots a small factory. On the loading dock, under a gray tin roof, women sort red and green tomatoes. She begs for work. As she puts tomatoes into boxes, she hallucinates that she is slicing open a juicy one and sprinkling it with salt. The boss pays her $14 for 2 hours' work. Lourdes's brother has a friend in Los Angeles who helps Lourdes get a fake Social Security card and a job. She moves in with a Beverly Hills couple to take care of their 3-year-old daughter. Their spacious home has carpet on the floors and mahogany panels on the walls. Her employers are kind. They pay her $125 a week. She gets nights and weekends off. Maybe, Lourdes tells herself, if she stays long enough, they will help her become legal. Every morning, as the couple leave for work, the little girl cries for her mother. Lourdes feeds her breakfast and thinks of Enrique and Belki. She asks herself, "Do my children cry like this? I'm giving this girl food instead of feeding my own children." To get the girl to eat, Lourdes pretends the spoon is an airplane. But each time the spoon lands in the girl's mouth, Lourdes is filled with sadness. In the afternoon, after the girl comes home from pre-kindergarten class, they thumb through picture books and play. The girl, so close to Enrique's age, is a constant reminder of her son. Many afternoons, Lourdes cannot contain her grief. She gives the girl a toy and dashes into the kitchen. There, out of sight, tears flow. After 7 months, she cannot take it. She quits and moves to a friend's place in Long Beach. Boxes arrive in Tegucigalpa bearing clothes, shoes, toy cars, a RoboCop doll, a television. Lourdes writes, "Do they like the things she is sending?" She tells Enrique to behave, to study hard. She has hopes for him. Graduation from high school, a white-collar job, maybe as an engineer. She pictures her son working in a crisp shirt and shiny shoes. She says she loves him. Enrique asks about his mother. "She'll be home soon," his grandmother assures him. "Don't worry, she'll be back." But his mother does not come. Her disappearance is incomprehensible. Enrique's bewilderment turns to confusion, and then to adolescent anger. When Enrique is 7, his father brings a woman home. To her, Enrique is an economic burden. One morning she spills hot cocoa and burns him. His father throws her out, but their separation is brief. Mom, Enrique's father tells the grandmother, I can't think of anyone but that woman. Enrique's father bathes, dresses, splashes on cologne, and follows her. Enrique tags along and begs to stay with him. But his father tells him to go back to his grandmother. His father begins a new family. Enrique sees him rarely, usually by chance. In time, Enrique's love turns to contempt. He doesn't love me. He loves the children he has with his wife, he tells Belki. I don't have a dad. His father notices. He looks at me as if he wasn't my son, as if he wants to strangle me, he tells Enrique's grandmother. Most of the blame, his father decides, belongs to Enrique's mother. She is the one who promised to come back. For Belki, their mother's disappearance is just as distressing. She lives with Aunt Rosa Amalia, one of her mother's sisters. On Mother's Day, Belki struggles through a celebration at school. That night she cries quietly alone in her room. Then she scolds herself. She should thank her mother for leaving. Without the money she sends for books and uniforms, Belki could not even attend school. She reminds herself of all the other things her mother ships south. Reebok tennis shoes, black sandals, the yellow bear and pink puppy stuffed toys on her bed. She commiserates with a friend whose mother has also left. They console each other. They know a girl whose mother died of a heart attack. At least, they say, ours are alive. But Rosa Amalia thinks the separation has caused deep emotional problems. To her, it seems that Belki is struggling with an unavoidable question. How can I be worth anything if my mother left me? There are days, Belki tells Aunt Rosa Amalia, when I wake up and feel so alone. Belki is temperamental. Sometimes she stops talking to everyone. When her mood turns dark, her grandmother warns the other children in the house. Pórtense bien porque la marea anda brava. You better behave because the seas are choppy. Confused by his mother's absence, Enrique turns to his grandmother. Alone now, he and his father's elderly mother share a shack, 30 feet square. Maria Marcos built it herself of wooden slats. Enrique can see daylight in the cracks. It has 4 rooms, 3 without electricity. There is no running water. Gutters carry rain off the patched tin roof into 2 barrels. A trickle of cloudy white sewage runs past the front gate. On a well-worn rock nearby, Enrique's grandmother washes musty, used clothing she sells door to door. Next to the rock is the latrine, a concrete hole. Beside it are buckets for bathing. The shack is in Carizal, one of Tegucigalpa's poorest neighborhoods. Sometimes Enrique looks across the rolling hills to the neighborhood where he and his mother lived, and where Belki still lives with their mother's family. They are 6 miles apart. They hardly ever visit. Lourdes sends Enrique $50 a month, occasionally $100, sometimes nothing. It is enough for food, but not for school clothes, fees, notebooks, or pencils, which are expensive in Honduras. There is never enough for a birthday present. But Grandmother Maria hugs him and wishes him a cheery, Feliz cumpleaños. Your mom can't send enough, she says, so we both have to work. Enrique loves to climb his grandmother's guayaba tree, but there is no more time for play now. After school, Enrique sells tamales and plastic bags of fruit juice from a bucket hung in the crook of his arm. Tamarindo! Piña! He shouts. Sometimes Enrique takes his wares to a service station where diesel-belching buses rumble into Carizal. Jostling among mango and avocado vendors, he sells cups of diced fruit. After he turns 10, he rides buses alone to an outdoor food market. He stuffs tiny bags with nutmeg, curry powder, and paprika, then seals them with hot wax. He pauses at big black gates in front of the market and calls out, Va a querer especias? Who wants spices? He has no vendor's license, so he keeps moving, darting between wooden carts piled with papayas. Younger children, 5 and 6 years old, dot the curbs, thrusting fistfuls of tomatoes and chilies at shoppers. Others offer to carry purchases of fruits and vegetables from stall to stall in rustic wooden wheelbarrows in exchange for tips. Te ayudo? May I help you? They ask. Arms taut, backs stooped, the boys heave forward, their carts bulging. In between sales, some of the young market workers sniff glue. Grandmother Maria cooks plantains, spaghetti, and fresh eggs. Now and then she kills a chicken and prepares it for him. In return, when she is sick, Enrique rubs medicine on her back. He brings water to her in bed. 2 or 3 times a week, Enrique lugs buckets filled with drinking water, one on each shoulder, from the water truck at the bottom of the hill up to his grandmother's house. Every year on Mother's Day, he makes a heart-shaped card at school and presses it into her hand. I love you very much, Grandma, he writes. But she is not his mother. Enrique longs to hear Lourdes's voice. Once he tries to call her collect from a public telephone in his neighborhood. He can't get the call to go through. His only way of talking to her is at the home of his mother's cousin, Maria Eldemira Sanchez Mejia, one of the few family members who has a telephone. His mother seldom calls. 1 year, she does not call at all. I thought you had died, girl, Maria Eldemira says, when she finally does call. Better to send money, Lourdes replies, than burn it up on the phone. But there is another reason she hasn't called. Her life in the United States is nothing like the television images she saw in Honduras. Lourdes shares an apartment bedroom with 3 other women. She sleeps on the floor. A boyfriend from Honduras, Santos, joins her in Long Beach. Lourdes is hopeful. She's noticed that her good friend Alma saves much faster now that she has moved in with a Mexican boyfriend. The boyfriend pays Alma's rent and bills. Alma can shop for her 2 girls in Honduras at nice stores, such as JCPenney and Sears. She's saving to build a house in Honduras. Santos, who once worked with Lourdes's stepfather as a bricklayer, is such a speedy worker that in Honduras his nickname was El Velos. With Santos here, Lourdes tells herself, she will save enough to bring her children within 2 years. If not, she will take her savings and return to Honduras to build a little house and corner grocery store. Lourdes unintentionally gets pregnant. She struggles through the difficult pregnancy, working in a refrigerated fish factory, packing and weighing salmon and catfish all day. Her water breaks at 5 one summer morning. Lourdes's boyfriend, who likes to get drunk, goes to a bar to celebrate. He asks a female bar buddy to take Lourdes to the public hospital. Lourdes's temperature shoots up to 105 degrees. She becomes delirious. The bar buddy wipes sweat dripping from Lourdes's brow. Bring my mother, bring my mother, Lourdes moans. Lourdes has trouble breathing. A nurse slips an oxygen mask over her face. She gives birth to a girl, Diana. After 2 days, Lourdes must leave the hospital. She is still sick and weak. The hospital will hold her baby 1 more day. Santos has never shown up at the hospital. He isn't answering their home telephone. His drinking buddy has taken Lourdes's clothes back to her apartment. Lourdes leaves the hospital wearing a blue paper disposable robe. She doesn't even have a pair of underwear. She sits in her apartment kitchen and sobs, longing for her mother, her sister, anyone familiar. Santos returns the next morning, after a 3-day drinking binge. Ya vino? Has it arrived? He passes out before Lourdes can answer. Lourdes goes, alone, to get Diana from the hospital. Santos loses his job making airplane parts. Lourdes falls on a pallet and hurts her shoulder. She complains to her employer about the pain. 2 months after Diana's birth, she is fired. She gets a job at a pizzeria and bar. Santos doesn't want her to work there. One night, Santos is drunk and jealous that Lourdes has given a male co-worker a ride home. He punches Lourdes in the chest, knocking her to the ground. The next morning, there is coagulated blood under the skin on her breast. "I won't put up with this," Lourdes tells herself. When Diana is 1 year